Cuthbert gave a ululating yell to hear his voice bounce back at him from the bluffs ahead. A pack of chattering billy bumblers broke from this green place and went racing back southeast toward the drop. "That's Hanging Rock," Roland said. "There's a spring at the base of it, only one in these parts, they say." It was all the talk that passed between them on the ride out, but a look of unmistakable relief passed between Cuthbert and Alain behind Roland's back. For the last 3 weeks they had pretty much marched in place as summer rolled around them and past them. It was all well for Roland to say they must wait. They must pay greatest attention to the things that didn't matter and count the things which did from the corners of their eyes. But neither of them quite trusted the dreamy, disconnected air which Roland wore these days, like his own special version of Clay Reynolds's cloak. They didn't talk about this between themselves. They didn't have to. Both knew that if Roland began courting the pretty girl whom Mayor Thorin meant for his Jilly, and who else could that long blonde hair have belonged to, they would be in very bad trouble. But Roland showed no courting plumage. Neither of them spied any more blonde hairs on his shirt collars. And tonight he seemed more himself, as if he had put that cloak of abstraction aside. Temporarily, mayhap. Permanently, if they were lucky. They could only wait and see. In the end, Ka would tell, as it always did. A mile or so from the bluffs, the strong sea breeze which had been at their backs for the whole ride suddenly dropped, and they heard the low, atonal squalling from the cleft that was Eyebolt Canyon. Alain pulled up, grimacing like a man who was bitten into a fruit of extravagant sourness. All he could think of was a handful of sharp pebbles squeezed and ground together in a strong hand. Buzzards circled above the canyon, as if drawn to the sound. "The lookout don't like it, Will," Cuthbert said, knocking his knuckles on the skull. "I don't like it much either. What are we out here for?"
"To count," Roland said. "We were sent to count everything and see everything, and this is something to count and see."
"Oh, aye," Cuthbert said. He held his horse in with some effort. The low, grinding wail of the thinny had made it skittish. 1,614 fishing nets, 710 boats small, 214 boats large, 70 oxen that nobody will admit to, and on the north of town, one thinny. Whatever the hell that is."
"We're going to find out," Roland said. They rode into the sound, and although none of them liked it, no one suggested they go back. They had come all the way out here, and Roland was right. This was their job. Besides, they were curious. The mouth of the canyon had been pretty well stopped up with brush, as Susan had told Roland it would be. Come fall, most of it would probably be dead, but now the stacked branches still bore leaves and made it hard to see into the canyon. A path led through the center of the brush pile, but it was narrow for the horses, who might have balked at going through anyway, and in the failing light Roland could make out hardly anything.
"Are we going in?" Cuthbert asked. "Let the recording angel note that I'm against, although I'll offer no mutiny."
Roland had no intention of taking them through the brush and toward the source of that sound, not when he had only the vaguest idea of what a thinny was. He had asked a few questions about it over the last few weeks and gotten little useful response.
"I'd stay away," was the extent of Sheriff Avery's advice.
So far, his best information was still what he had gotten from Susan on the night he met her. "Sit easy, Bert. We're not going in."
"Good,"
Alain said softly, and Roland smiled. There was a path up the canyon's west side, steep and narrow, but passable if they were careful. They went single file, stopping once to clear a rockfall, pitching splintered chunks of shale and hornfels into the groaning trench to their right. When this was done, and just as the three of them were preparing to mount up again, a large bird of some sort, perhaps a grouse, perhaps a prairie chicken, rose above the lip of the canyon in an explosive whirr of feathers. Roland dipped for his guns and saw both Cuthbert and Alain doing the same. Quite funny, considering that their firearms were wrapped in protective oilcloth and secreted beneath the floorboards of the Bar K bunkhouse. They looked at each other, said nothing except with their eyes, which said plenty, and went on. Roland found that the effect of being this close to the thinny was cumulative. It wasn't a sound you could get used to. Quite the contrary, in fact. The longer you were in the immediate vicinity of Eyebolt Canyon, the more that sound scraped away at your brain. It got into your teeth as well as your ears. It vibrated in the knot of nerves below the breastbone and seemed to eat at the damp and delicate tissue behind the eyes. Most of all, though, it got into your head, telling you that everything you had ever been afraid of was just behind the next curve of the trail, or yonder pile of tumbled rock, waiting to snake out of its place and get you. Once they got to the flat and barren ground at the top of the path, and the sky opened out above them again, it was a little better. But by then the light was almost gone. And when they dismounted and walked to the canyon's crumbling edge, they could see little but shadows.
"No good," Cuthbert said disgustedly. "We should have left earlier, Roland. Will, I mean. What dummies we are."
"I can be Roland to you out here, if you like. And we'll see what we came to see and count what we came to count. One thinny, just as you said. Only wait." They waited. And not 20 minutes later, the peddler's moon rose above the horizon. A perfect summer moon, huge and orange. It loomed in the darkening violet swim of the sky like a crashing planet. On its face, as clear as anyone had ever seen it, was the peddler, he who came out of Nones with his sack full of squealing souls, a hunched figure made of smudged shadows, with a pack clearly visible over one cringing shoulder. Behind it, the orange light seemed to flame like hellfire.
"Ugh," Cuthbert said, "that's an ill sight to see with that sound coming up from below."
Yet they held their ground, and their horses, which periodically yanked back on their reins, as if to tell them they should already be gone from this place, and the moon rose in the sky, shrinking a little as it went, and turning silver. Eventually it rose enough to cast its bony light into Eyebolt Canyon. The three boys stood looking down. None of them spoke. Roland didn't know about his friends, but he didn't think he himself could have spoken, even if called on to do so. A box canyon, very short and steep-sided, Susan had said, and the description was perfectly accurate. She'd also said Eyebolt looked like a chimney lying on its side, and Roland supposed that was also true, if you allowed that a falling chimney might break up a little on impact and lie with one crooked place in its middle. Up to that crook, the canyon floor looked ordinary enough. Even the litter of bones, the moon showed them, was not extraordinary. Many animals which wandered into box canyons hadn't the wit to find their way back out again, and with Eyebolt the possibility of escape was further reduced by the choke of brush piled at the canyon's mouth. The sides were much too steep to climb, except maybe for one place, just before that crooked little jog. There Roland saw a kind of groove running up the canyon wall, with enough jutting spurs inside it to maybe provide handholds. There was no real reason for him to note this. He just did, as he would go on noting potential escape routes his entire life. Beyond the jag in the canyon floor was something none of them had ever seen before. And when they got back to the bunkhouse several hours later, they all agreed that they weren't sure exactly what they had seen. The latter part of Eyebolt Canyon was obscured by a sullen, silvery liquescence from which snakes of smoke or mist were rising in streamers. The liquid seemed to move sluggishly, lapping at the walls which held it in. Later they would discover that both liquid and mist were a light green. It was only the moonlight that had made them look silver. As they watched, a dark, flying shape, perhaps it was the same one that had frightened them before, skimmed down toward the surface of the thinny. It snatched something out of the air, a bug, another smaller bird, and then began to rise again. Before it could, a silvery arm of liquid rose from the canyon's floor. For a moment that soupy, grinding rumble rose a notch, and became almost a voice. It snatched the bird out of the air and dragged it down. Greenish light, brief and unfocused, flashed across the surface of the thinny like electricity, and was gone. The three boys stared at each other with frightened eyes. "Jump in, gunslinger," a voice suddenly called. It was the voice of the thinny. It was the voice of his father. It was also the voice of Martin, the enchanter, Martin, the seducer. Most terrible of all, it was his own voice. "Jump in, and let all these cares cease. There is no love of girls to worry you here, and no mourning of lost mothers to weigh your child's heart. Only the hum of the growing cavity at the center of the universe. Only the punky sweetness of rotting flesh. Come, gunslinger. Be a part of the thinny." Dreamy-faced and blank-eyed, Alain began walking along the edge of the drop, his right boot so close to it that the heel puffed little clouds of dust over the chasm and sent clusters of pebbles down into it. Before he could get more than 5 steps, Roland grabbed him by the belt and yanked him roughly back. "Where do you think you're going?" Alain looked at him with sleepwalker's eyes. They began to clear, but slowly. "I don't know, Roland." Below them, the thinny hummed and growled and sang. There was a sound as well, an oozing, sludgy mutter. "I know," Cuthbert said. "I know where we're all going. Back to the barquet. Come on, let's get out of here." He looked pleadingly at Roland. "Please, it's awful." "All right." But before he led them back to the path, he stepped to the edge and looked down at the smoky silver ooze below him. "Counting," he said with a kind of clear defiance, "counting one thinny." Then, lowering his voice, "And be damned to you." 3. Their composure returned as they rode back. The sea breeze in their faces was wonderfully restorative after the dead and somehow baked smell of the canyon and the thinny. As they rode up the drop on a long diagonal so as to save the horses a little, Alain said, "What do we do next, Roland, do you know?" "No, as a matter of fact, I don't." "Supper would be a start," Cuthbert said brightly, and tapped the lookout's hollow skull for emphasis. "You know what I mean." "Yes," Cuthbert agreed. "And I'll tell you something, Roland. Will, please, now that we're back on the drop, let me be Will." "Aye, fine. I'll tell you something, Will. We can't go on counting nets and boats and looms and wheel irons much longer. We're running out of things that don't matter. I believe that looking stupid will become a good deal harder once we move to the horse-breeding side of life as it's lived in Hambry."
"Aye," Roland said. He stopped Rusher and looked back the way they had come. He was momentarily enchanted by the sight of horses, apparently infected with a kind of moon madness, frolicking and racing across the silvery grass. "But I tell you both again, this is not just about horses. Does Farson need them? Aye, mayhap, so does the affiliation. Oxen as well. But there are horses everywhere. Perhaps not as good as these, I'll admit, but any port does in a storm, so they say. So if it's not horses, what is it? Until we know, or decide we'll never know, we go on as we are." Part of the answer was waiting for them back at the bar K. It was perched on the hitching rail and flicking its tail saucily. When the pigeon hopped into Roland's hand, he saw that one of its wings was oddly frayed. Some animal, likely a cat, had crept up on it close enough to pounce, he reckoned. The note curled against the pigeon's leg was short, but it explained a good deal of what they hadn't understood. "I'll have to see her again," Roland thought after reading it, and felt a surge of gladness. His pulse quickened, and in the cold silver light of the peddler's moon, he smiled. 9. Sitgo. 1. The peddler's moon began to wane. It would take the hottest, fairest part of the summer with it when it went. On an afternoon 4 days past the full, the old mozo from Mayor's house — Miguel had been there long before Hart Thorin's time and would likely be there long after Thorin had gone back to his ranch — showed up at the house Susan shared with her aunt. He was leading a beautiful chestnut mare by a hack. It was the second of the three promised horses, and Susan recognized Felicia at once. The mare had been one of her childhood's favorites. Susan embraced Miguel and covered his bearded cheeks with kisses. The old man's wide grin would have showed every tooth in his head if he'd had any left to show.
"Gracias, gracias. 1,000 thanks, old father," she told him.
"De nada," he replied, and handed her the bridle. "It is the mayor's earnest gift."
She watched him away, the smile slowly fading from her lips. Felicia stood docilely beside her, her dark brown coat shining like a dream in the summer sunlight. But this was no dream. It had seemed like one at first. That sense of unreality had been another inducement to walk into the trap, she now understood. But it was no dream. She had been proved honest. Now she found herself the recipient of earnest gifts from a rich man. The phrase was a sop to conventionality, of course, or a bitter joke, depending on one's mood and outlook. Felicia was no more a gift than Pylon had been. They were step-by-step fulfillments of the contract into which she had entered. Aunt Cord could express shock, but Susan knew the truth. What lay directly ahead was whoring, pure and simple. Aunt Cord was in the kitchen window as Susan walked her gift, which was really just returned property in her view, to the stable. She called out something passing cheery about how the horse was a good thing, that caring for it would give Susan less time for her megrims. Susan felt a hot reply rise to her lips and held it back. There had been a wary truce between the two of them since the shouting match about the shirts, and Susan didn't want to be the one to break it. There was too much on her mind and heart. She thought that one more argument with her aunt and she might simply snap like a dry twig under a boot. Because often silence is best, her father had told her when at age 10 or so she had asked him why he was always so quiet. The answer had puzzled her then, but now she understood better. She stabled Felicia next to Pylon, rubbed her down, fed her. While the mare munched oats, Susan examined her hooves. She didn't care much for the look of the iron the mare was wearing. That was seafront for you. And so she took her father's shoe bag from its nail beside the stable door, slung the strap over her head and shoulders so the bag hung on her hip, and walked the 2 miles to Hookie's stable and fancy livery. Feeling the leather bag bang against her hip brought back her father in a way so fresh and clear that grief pricked her again and made her feel like crying. She thought he would have been appalled at her current situation, perhaps even disgusted. And he would have liked Will Dearborn. Of that she was sure, liked him and approved of him for her. It was the final miserable touch. Two. She had known how to shoe most of her life, and even enjoyed it when her mood was right. It was dusty, elemental work, with always the possibility of a healthy kick in the slats to relieve the boredom and bring a girl back to reality. But of making shoes, she knew nothing, nor wished to. Brian Hookie made them at the forge behind his barn and hostelry, however. Susan easily picked out 4 new ones of the right size, enjoying the smell of horse flesh and fresh hay as she did. Fresh paint, too. Hookie's stable and smithy looked very well indeed. Glancing up, she saw not so much as a single hole in the barn roof. Times had been good for Hookie, it seemed. He wrote the new shoes up on a beam, still wearing his blacksmith's apron and squinting horribly out of one eye at his own figures.
When Susan began to speak haltingly to him about payment, he laughed, told her he knew she'd settle her accounts as soon as she could. God's bless her, yes. Sides, they weren't any of them going anywhere, were they? Nope, nope. All the time gently propelling her through the fragrant smells of hay and horses toward the door. He would not have treated even so small a matter as four iron shoes in such a carefree manner a year ago. But now she was Mayor Thorin's good friend, and things had changed. The afternoon sunlight was dazzling after the dimness of Hookie's barn, and she was momentarily blinded, groping forward toward the street with the leather bag bouncing on her hip and the shoes clashing softly inside. She had just a moment to register a shape looming in the brightness, and then it thumped into her hard enough to rattle her teeth and make Felicia's new shoes clang. She would have fallen but for strong hands that quickly reached out and grasped her shoulders. By then her eyes were adjusting, and she saw with dismay and amusement that the young man who had almost knocked her sprawling into the dirt was one of Will's friends, Richard Stockworth. "Oh, Si, your pardon," he said, brushing the arms of her dress as if he had knocked her over. "Are you well? Are you quite well?" "Quite well," she said, smiling. "Please don't apologize." She felt a sudden wild impulse to stand on tiptoe and kiss his mouth and say, "Give that to Will and tell him to never mind what I said. Tell him there are 1,000 more where that came from. Tell him to come and get every one." Instead, she fixed on a comic image, this Richard Stockworth smacking Will full on the mouth and saying it was from Susan Delgado. She began to giggle. She put her hands to her mouth, but it did no good. Si Stockworth smiled back at her, tentatively, cautiously. "He probably thinks I'm mad. And I am. I am." "Good day, Mr. Stockworth," she said, and passed on before she could embarrass herself further. "Good day, Susan Delgado," he called in return. She looked back once when she was 50 yards or so farther up the street, but he was already gone. Not into Hookie's, though. Of that she was quite sure. She wondered what Mr. Stockworth had been doing at that end of town to begin with. Half an hour later, as she took the new iron from her dad's shoe bag, she found out. There was a folded scrap of paper tucked between two of the shoes, and even before she unfolded it, she understood that her collision with Mr. Stockworth hadn't been an accident. She recognized Will's handwriting at once from the note in the bouquet. "Susan, can you meet me at Sitgo this evening or tomorrow evening? Very important. Has to do with what we discussed before. Please. W. P.S. Best you burn this note." She burned it at once, and as she watched the flames first flash up and then die down, she murmured over and over the one word in it which had struck her the hardest. "Please." Three. She and Aunt Cord ate a simple, silent evening meal, bread and soup, and when it was done, Susan rode Felicia out to the drop and watched the sun go down. She would not be meeting him this evening, no. She already owed too much sorrow to impulsive, unthinking behavior. But tomorrow? Why Sitgo? Has to do with what we discussed before. Yes, probably. She did not doubt his honor, although she had much come to wonder if he and his friends were who they said they were. He probably did want to see her for some reason which bore on his mission, although how the oil patch could have anything to do with too many horses on the drop she did not know. But there was something between them now, something sweet and dangerous. They might start off talking, but would likely end up kissing, and kissing would be just the start. Knowing didn't change feeling, though. She wanted to see him, needed to see him. So she sat astride her new horse, another of Hart Thorin's payments in advance on her virginity, and watched the sun swell and turn red in the west. She listened to the faint grumble of the thinny, and for the first time in her 16 years was truly torn by indecision. All she wanted stood against all she believed of honor, and her mind roared with conflict. Around all, like a rising wind around an unstable house, she felt the idea of Ka growing. Yet to give over one's honor for that reason was so easy, wasn't it? To excuse the fall of virtue by invoking all-powerful Ka. It was soft thinking. Susan felt as blind as she'd been when leaving the darkness of Brian Hookie's barn for the brightness of the street. At one point she cried silently in frustration without even being aware of it, and pervading her every effort to think clearly and rationally was her desire to kiss him again and to feel his hand cupping her breast. She had never been a religious girl, had little faith in the dim gods of mid-world. So at the last of it, with the sun gone and the sky above its point of exit going from red to purple, she tried to pray to her father. And an answer came, although whether from him or from her own heart, she didn't know. "Let Ka mind itself," the voice in her mind said. "It will anyway. It always does. If Ka should overrule your honor, so it will be. In the meantime, Susan, there's no one to mind it but yourself. Let Ka go and mind the virtue of your promise, hard as that may be." "All right," she said. In her current state, she discovered that any decision, even one that would cost her another chance to see Will, was a relief. "I'll honor my promise. Ka can take care of itself." In the gathering shadows, she clucked side mouth to Felicia and turned for home. Four. The next day was Sunday, the traditional cowboy's day of rest. Roland's little band took this day off as well. "It's fair enough that we should," Cuthbert said, "since we don't know what the hell we're doing in the first place." On this particular Sunday, their sixth since coming to Hambry, Cuthbert was in the upper market, lower market was cheaper, by and large, but too fishy-smelling for his liking, looking at brightly colored serapes and trying not to cry. For his mother had a serape, it was a great favorite of hers, and thinking of how she would ride out sometimes with it flowing back from her shoulders had filled him with homesickness so strong it was savage. Arthur Heath, Roland's kamai, missing his mama so badly his eyes were wet. It was a joke worthy of, well, worthy of Cuthbert Allgood. As he stood so, looking at the serapes and a hanging rack of dolina blankets, with his hands clasped behind his back like a patron in an art gallery and blinking back tears all the while, there came a light tap on his shoulder. He turned, and there was the girl with the blonde hair. Cuthbert wasn't surprised that Roland was smitten with her. She was nothing short of breathtaking, even dressed in jeans and a farm shirt. Her hair was tied back with a series of rough, rawhide hanks, and she had eyes of the brightest gray Cuthbert had ever seen. Cuthbert thought it was a wonder that Roland had been able to continue with any other aspect of his life at all, even down to the washing of his teeth. Certainly she came with a cure for Cuthbert. Sentimental thoughts of his mother disappeared in an instant. "Sigh," he said. It was all he could manage, at least to start with. She nodded and held out what the folk of Magus called a corvette. Little packet was the literal definition, little purse was the practical one. These small leather accessories, big enough for a few coins but not much more, were more often carried by ladies than gentlemen, although that was not a hard and fast rule of fashion. "Ye drop this, Cully," she said. "Nay, thank ye, Si." This one might well have been the property of a man, plain black leather and unadorned by foufraws. But he had never seen it before, never carried a corvette, for that matter. "It's yours," she said, and her eyes were now so intense that her gaze felt hot on his skin. He should have understood at once, but he had been blinded by her unexpected appearance. Also, he admitted, by her cleverness. You somehow didn't expect cleverness from a girl this beautiful. Beautiful girls did not, as a rule, have to be clever. So far as Bert could tell, all beautiful girls had to do was wake up in the morning.
It is.
Oh, I, he said, almost snatching the little purse from her. He could feel a foolish grin overspreading his face. Now that you mention it, Si,
Susan.
Her eyes were grave and watchful above her smile.
Let me be Susan to you, I pray.
With pleasure. I cry your pardon, Susan. It's just that my mind and memory, realizing it's Sanday, have joined hands and gone off on holiday together. Eloped, you might say, and left me temporarily without a brain in my head. He might well have rattled on like that for another hour, he had before, to that both Roland and Elaine could testify, but she stopped him.
I can easily believe ye have no control over your mind, Mr. Heath, or the tongue hung below it, but perhaps ye'll take better care of your purse in the future. Good day.
She was gone before he could get another word out. 5. Bert found Roland where he so often was these days, out on the part of the drop that was called Town Lookout by many of the locals. It gave a fair view of Hambry, dreaming away its sandy afternoon in a blue haze, but Cuthbert rather doubted the Hambry view was what drew his oldest friend back here time after time. He thought that its view of the Delgado house was the more likely reason. This day Roland was with Elaine, neither of them saying a word. Cuthbert had no trouble accepting the idea that some people could go long periods of time without talking to each other, but he did not think he would ever understand it. He came riding up to them at a gallop, reached inside his shirt, and pulled out the Corvette. "From Susan Delgado. She gave it to me in the upper market. She's beautiful, and she's also as wily as a snake. I say that with utmost admiration." Roland's face filled with light and life. When Cuthbert tossed him the Corvette, he caught it one-handed and pulled the lace tie with his teeth. Inside, where a traveling man would have kept his few scraps of money, there was a single folded piece of paper. Roland read this quickly, the light going out of his eyes, the smile fading off his mouth.
"What does it say?"
Alan asked. Roland handed it to him and then went back to looking out at the drop. It wasn't until he saw the very real desolation in his friend's eyes that Cuthbert fully realized how far into Roland's life, and hence into all their lives, Susan Delgado had come. Elaine handed him the note. It was only a single line, two sentences.
"It's best we don't meet. I'm sorry."
Cuthbert read it twice, as if rereading might change it, then handed it back to Roland. Roland put the note back into the Corvette, tied the lace, and then tucked the little purse into his own shirt. Cuthbert hated silence worse than danger. It was danger, to his mind. But every conversational opening he tried in his mind seemed callow and unfeeling, given the look on his friend's face. It was as if Roland had been poisoned. Cuthbert was disgusted at the thought of that lovely young girl bumping hips with the long and bony mayor of Hambry, but the look on Roland's face now called up stronger emotions. For that he could hate her. At last Elaine spoke up, almost timidly.
"And now, Roland? Shall we have a hunt out there at the oil patch without her?"
Cuthbert admired that. Upon first meeting him, many people dismissed Elaine Johns as something of a dullard. That was very far from the truth. Now, in a diplomatic way Cuthbert could never have matched, he had pointed out that Roland's unhappy first experience with love did not change their responsibilities. And Roland responded, raising himself off the saddle horn and sitting up straight. The strong golden light of that summer's afternoon lit his face in harsh contrasts. And for a moment that face was haunted by the ghost of the man he would become. Cuthbert saw that ghost and shivered, not knowing what he saw, only knowing that it was awful. "The big coffin hunters," he said. "Did you see them in town?"
"Jonas and Reynolds," Cuthbert answered.
"Still no sign of DePape. I think Jonas must have choked him and thrown him over the sea cliffs in a fit of pique after that night in the bar."
Roland shook his head. "Jonas needs the men he trusts too much to waste them. He's as far out on thin ice as we are. No, DePape's just been sent off for a while."
"Sent where?" Elaine asked.
"Where he'll have to shit in the bushes and sleep in the rain if the weather's bad."
Roland laughed shortly, without much humor. Jonas has got the pape running our back trail more likely than not. Alain grunted softly, in surprise that wasn't really surprise. Roland sat easily astride Rusher, looking out over the dreamy depths of land at the grazing horses. With one hand he unconsciously rubbed the corvette he had tucked into his shirt. At last he looked around at them again. "We'll wait a bit longer," he said. "Perhaps you'll change your mind." "Roland," Alain began, and his tone was deadly in its gentleness. Roland raised his hands before Alain could go on. "Doubt me not, Alain. I speak as my father's son." "All right." Alain reached out and briefly gripped Roland's shoulder. As for Cuthbert, he reserved judgment. Roland might or might not be acting as his father's son. Cuthbert guessed that at this point Roland hardly knew his own mind at all. "Do you remember what Court used to say was the primary weakness of maggots such as us?" Roland asked with a trace of a smile. "You run without consideration and fall in a hole," Alain quoted in a gruff imitation that made Cuthbert laugh aloud. Roland's smile broadened a touch. "Aye. They're words I mean to remember, boys. I'll not upset this cart in order to see what's in it. Not unless there's no other choice. Susan may come around yet, given time to think. I believe she would have agreed to meet me already if not for other matters between us." He paused, and for a little while there was quiet among them. "I wish our fathers hadn't sent us," Milan said at last, although it was Roland's father who had sent them, and all three knew it. "We're too young for matters such as these, too young by years." "We did all right that night in the rest," Cuthbert said. "That was training, not guile. And they didn't take us seriously. That won't happen again." "They wouldn't have sent us, not my father, not yours, if they'd known what we'd find," Roland said. "But now we found it, and now we're for it." "Yes?" Alain and Cuthbert nodded. They were for it, all right. There no longer seemed any doubt of that. "In any case, it's too late to worry about it now. We'll wait and hope for Susan. I'd rather not go near Sitka without someone from Hambry who knows the lay of the place. But if the pape comes back, we'll have to take our chance. God knows what he may find out, or what stories he may invent to please Jonas, or what Jonas may do after they palaver. There may be shooting. After all this creeping around, I'd almost welcome it," Cuthbert said. "Will you send her another note, Will Dearborn?" Alain asked. Roland thought about it. Cuthbert laid an interior bet with himself on which way Roland would go, and lost. "No," he said at last. "We'll have to give her time, hard as that is, and hope her curiosity will bring her around." With that, he turned Rusher toward the abandoned bunkhouse which now served them as home. Cuthbert and Alain followed. 6. Susan worked herself hard the rest of that Sunday, mucking out the stables, carrying water, washing down all the steps. Aunt Cord watched all this in silence, her expression one of mingled doubt and amazement. Susan cared not a bit for how her aunt looked. She wanted only to exhaust herself and avoid another sleepless night. It was over. Will would know it as well now, and that was to the good. Let done be done. "Are ye daft, girl?" was all Aunt Cord asked her as Susan dumped her last pail of dirty rinse water behind the kitchen. "It's Sunday." "Not daft a bit," she replied shortly, without looking around. She accomplished the first half of her aim, going to bed just after moonrise with tired arms, aching legs, and a throbbing back. But sleep still did not come. She lay in bed wide-eyed and unhappy. The hours passed, the moon set, and still Susan couldn't sleep. She looked into the dark and wondered if there was any possibility, even the slightest, that her father had been murdered. To stop his mouth, to close his eyes. Finally she reached the conclusion Roland had already come to. If there had been no attraction for her in those eyes of his, or the touch of his hands and lips, she would have agreed in a flash to the meeting he wanted, if only to set her troubled mind to rest. At this realization, relief overspread her, and she was able to sleep. 7. Late the next afternoon, while Roland and his friends were at Fives in the Traveler's Rest, cold beef sandwiches and gallons of white iced tea, not as good as that made by Deputy Dave's wife, but not bad, Sheeny came in from outside, where he'd been watering his flowers. He was wearing his pink sombrero and a wide grin. In one hand, he held a little packet.
"Hello there, you little coffin hunters," he cried cheerfully, and made a bow, which was an amusingly good imitation of their own.
Cuthbert particularly enjoyed seeing such a bow done in gardening sandals.
"How be you? Well, I'm hoping so I do."
"Right as rain barrels," Cuthbert said. "But none of us enjoys being called little coffin hunters, so maybe you could just play soft on that, all right?"
"Aye," Sheeny said, as cheerful as ever. "Aye, Mr. Arthur Heath, good fellow who saved my life."
He paused and looked puzzled for a moment, as if unable to remember why he had approached them in the first place. Then his eyes cleared, his grin shone out, and he held the packet out to Roland.
"For you, Will Dearborn."
"Really? What is it?"
"Seeds, so they are."
"From you, Sheeny?"
"Oh, no."
Roland took the packet, just an envelope which had been folded over and sealed. There was nothing written on the front or back, and the tips of his fingers felt no seeds within. "Who from then?"
"Can't remember,"
said Sheeny, who then cast his eyes aside. His brains had been stirred just enough, Roland reflected, so that he would never be unhappy for long and would never be able to lie at all. Then his eyes, hopeful and timid, came back to Roland's.
"I remember what I was supposed to say to you, though."
"Aye? Then say it, Sheeny." Speaking as one who recites a painfully memorized line, both proud and nervous, he said,
"These are the seeds you scattered on the drop."
Roland's eyes blazed so fiercely that Sheeny stumbled back a step. He gave his sombrero a quick tug, turned, and hurried back to the safety of his flowers. He liked Will Dearborn and Will's friends, especially Mr. Arthur Heath, who sometimes said things that made Sheeny laugh fit to split. But in that moment, he saw something in Will's eyes that frightened him badly. In that instant, he understood that Will was as much a killer as the one in the cloak, or the one who had wanted Sheeny to lick his boots clean, or old white-haired Jonas with the trembly voice. As bad as them, or even worse. Eight. Roland slipped the seed packet into his shirt and didn't open it until the three of them were back on the porch of the barquet. In the distance, the thinny grumbled, making their horses twitch their ears nervously.
"Well?"
Cuthbert asked at last, unable to restrain himself any longer. Roland took the envelope from inside his shirt and tore it open. As he did, he reflected that Susan had known exactly what to say. To a nicety. The others bent in, Alain from his left and Cuthbert from his right, as he unfolded the single scrap of paper. Again he saw her simple, neatly made writing, the message not much longer than the previous one. Very different in content, however.
"There is an orange grove a mile off the road on the town side of Sitgo. Meet me there at moonrise. Come alone. S."
And below that, printed in emphatic little letters, "Burn this."
"We'll keep a lookout," Alain said. Roland nodded. "Aye, but from a distance."
Then he burned the note. 9. The orange grove was a neatly kept rectangle of about a dozen rows at the end of a partly overgrown cart track. Roland arrived there after dark, but still a good half hour before the rapidly thinning peddler would haul himself over the horizon once more. As the boy wandered along one of the rows, listening to the somehow skeletal sounds from the oil patch to the north, squealing pistons, grinding gears, thudding drive shafts, he was struck by deep homesickness. It was the fragile fragrance of orange blossoms, a bright runner laid over the darker stench of oil, that brought it on. This toy grove was nothing like the great apple orchards of New Canaan, except somehow it was. There was the same feeling of dignity and civilization here, of much time devoted to something not strictly necessary. And in this case, he suspected, not very useful either. Oranges grown this far north of the warm latitudes were probably almost as sour as lemons. Still, when the breeze stirred the trees, the smell made him think of Gilead with bitter longing. And for the first time, he considered the possibility that he might never see home again, that he had become as much a wanderer as old Peddler Moon in the sky. He heard her, but not until she was almost on top of him. If she'd been an enemy instead of a friend, he might still have had time to draw and fire, but it would have been close. He was filled with admiration, and as he saw her face in the starlight, he felt his heart gladden. She halted when he turned and merely looked at him, her hands linked before her at her waist in a way that was sweetly and unconsciously childlike. He took a step toward her, and they came up in what he took for alarm. He stopped, confused. But he had misread her gesture in the chancy light. She could have stopped then, but chose not to. She stepped toward him deliberately, a tall young woman in a split riding skirt and plain black boots. Her sombrero hung down on her back against the bound rope of her hair.
"Will Dearborn? We are met both fair and ill," she said in a trembling voice.
And then he was kissing her. They burned against one another as the peddler rose in the famine of its last quarter. Ten. Inside her lonely hut, high on the coos, Rhea sat at her kitchen table, bent over the glass the big coffin hunters had brought her a month and a half ago. Her face was bathed in its pink glow, and no one would have mistaken it for the face of a girl any longer. She had extraordinary vitality, and it had carried her for many years. Only the longest-lived residents of Hambry had any idea of how old Rhea of the Coos actually was, and they only the vaguest. But the glass was finally sapping it, sucking it out of her as a vampire sucks blood. Behind her, the hut's larger room was even dingier and more cluttered than usual. These days she had no time for even a pretense of cleaning. The glass ball took up all her time. When she wasn't looking into it, she was thinking of looking into it. And, oh, such things she had seen. Ermot twined around one of her scrawny legs, hissing with agitation, but she barely noticed him. Instead, she bent even closer into the ball's poison pink glow, enchanted by what she saw there. It was the girl who had come to her to be proved honest, and the young man she had seen the first time she'd looked into the ball, the one she had mistaken for a gunslinger until she had realized his youth. The foolish girl who had come to Rhea singing and left in a more proper silence had proved honest and might well be honest yet. Certainly she kissed and touched the boy with a virgin's mingled greed and timidity, but she wouldn't be honest much longer if they kept on the way they were going. And wouldn't Hart Thorin be in for a surprise when he took his supposedly pure young Jilly to bed? There were ways to fool men about that. Men practically begged to be fooled about that. A thimble of pig's blood would serve nicely, but she wouldn't know that. Oh, this was too good. And to think she could watch Miss Haughty brought low right here in this wonderful glass. Oh, it was too good. Too wonderful.
She leaned closer still, the deep sockets of her eyes filling with pink fire. Ermot, sensing that she remained immune to his blandishments, crawled disconsolately away across the floor in search of bugs. Musty pranced away from him, spitting feline curses, his six-legged shadow huge and misshapen on the fire-struck wall. 11. Roland sensed the moment rushing at them.
Somehow he managed to step away from her, and she stepped back from him, her eyes wide and her cheeks flushed. He could see that flush even in the light of the newly risen moon. His balls were throbbing. His groin felt full of liquid lead. She half turned away from him, and Roland saw that her sombrero had gone askew on her back. He reached out one trembling hand and straightened it. She clasped his fingers in a brief but strong grip, then bent to pick up her riding gloves, which she had stripped off in her need to touch him skin to skin. When she stood again, the wash of blood abruptly left her face, and she reeled. But for his hands on her shoulders, steadying her, she might have fallen. She turned toward him, eyes rueful.
"What are we to do? Oh, Will, what are we to do?"
"The best we can," he said, "as we both always have, as our fathers taught us."
"This is mad."
Roland, who had never felt anything so sane in his life, even the deep ache in his groin felt sane and right, said nothing.
"Do you know how dangerous it is?"
she asked, and went on before he could reply.
"Aye, you do. I can see you do. If we were seen together at all, 'twould be serious. To be seen as we just were."
She shivered. He reached for her, and she stepped back.
"Best you don't, Will. If you do, won't be nothing done between us but spooning, unless that was your intention."
"You know it wasn't." She nodded.
"Have you set your friends to watch?"
"Aye," he said. And then his face opened in that unexpected smile she loved so well. "But not where they can watch us."
"Thank the gods for that," she said, and laughed rather distractedly.
Then she stepped closer to him, so close that he was hard put not to take her in his arms again. She looked curiously up into his face.
"Who are you really, Will?"
"Almost who I say I am. That's the joke of this, Susan. My friends and I weren't sent here because we were drunk and helling, but we weren't sent here to uncover any fell plot or secret conspiracy either. We were just boys to be put out of the way in a time of danger. All that's happened since..." He shook his head to show how helpless he felt. And Susan thought again of her father saying, "Ka was like a wind. When it came, it might take your chickens, your house, your barn, even your life."
"And is Will Dearborn your real name?"
He shrugged. "One name's as good as another, I wot, if the heart that answers to it is true. Susan, you were at Mayor's house today, for my friend Richard saw you ride up."
"Aye, fittings," she said. "For I am to be this year's reaping girl. It's heart's choice, nothing I would have ever had on my own, mark I say it. A lot of foolishness, and hard on Olive as well, I warrant."
"You will make the most beautiful reap girl that ever was," he said, and the clear sincerity in his voice made her tingle with pleasure. Her cheeks grew warm again. There were 5 changes of costume for the reaping girl between the noon feast and the bonfire at dusk, each more elaborate than the last. In Gilead there would have been 9, in that way Susan didn't know how lucky she was. And she would have worn all 5 happily for Will had he been the reaping lad. This year's lad was Jamie McCann, a pallid and whey-faced stand-in for Hart Thorin, who was approximately 40 years too old and gray for the job. Even more happily would she have worn the 6th, a silvery shift with wisp-thin straps and a hem that stopped high on her thighs. This was a costume no one but Maria, her maid, Conchetta, her seamstress, and Hart Thorin would ever see. It was the one she would be wearing when she went to the old man's couch as his Jilly after the feast was over. "When you were up there, did you see the ones who call themselves the Big Coffin Hunters?"
"I saw Jonas and the one with the cloak standing together in the courtyard and talking," she said.
"Not DePape, the redhead?"
She shook her head.
"Do you know the game Castles, Susan?"
"Aye, my father showed me when I was small."
"Then you know how the red pieces stand at one end of the board and the white at the other, how they come around the hillocks and creep toward each other, setting screens for cover. What's going on here in Hambury is very much like that. And as in the game, it has now become a question of who will break cover first. Do you understand? She nodded at once.
In the game, the first one around his hillock is vulnerable.
In life, too. Always. But sometimes even staying in cover is difficult. My friends and I have counted nearly everything we dare count. To count the rest,
the horses on the drop, for instance.
Aye, just so. To count them would be to break cover, or the oxen we know about. Her eyebrows shot up.
There are no oxen in Hambry. You must be mistaken about that.
No mistake.
Where?
The Rocking H. Now her eyebrows drew back down and knitted in a thoughtful frown.
That's Laszlo Reimer's place.
Aye, Kimba's brother. Nor are those the only treasures hidden away in Hambry these days. There are extra wagons, extra tack hidden in barns belonging to members of the Horsemen's Association, extra caches of feed.
Well, no!
Yes, all that and more. But to count them, to be seen counting them, is to break cover, to risk being castled. Our recent days have been pretty nightmarish. We try to look profitably busy without moving over to the drop side of Hambry, where most of the danger lies. It's harder and harder to do. Then we received a message.
A message? How? From whom?
Best you not know those things, I think. But it's led us to believe that some of the answers we're looking for may be at Sitgo.
Well, do you think that what's out here may help me to know more about what happened to my dad?
I don't know. It's possible, I suppose, but not likely. All I know for sure is that I finally have a chance to count something that matters and not be seen doing it. His blood had cooled enough for him to hold out his hand to her. Susan's had cooled enough for her to take it in good confidence. She had put her glove back on again, however. Better safe than sorry.
Come on, she said. I know a path.
12. In the moon's pale half-light, Susan led him out of the orange grove and toward the thump and squeak of the oil patch. Those sounds made Roland's back prickle, made him wish for one of the guns hidden under the bunkhouse floorboards back at the bar K.
"You can't trust me, Will, but that doesn't mean I'll be much help to you," she said in a voice just a notch above a whisper. "I've been within hearing distance of Sitgo my whole life, but I could count the number of times I've actually been in it on the fingers of both hands, so I could. The first two or three were on dares from my friends."
"And then?"
"With my dad. He were always interested in the old people, and my Aunt Court always said he'd come to a bad end meddling in their leavings."
She swallowed hard.
"And he did come to a bad end. Although I doubt it were the old people responsible. Poor Dad."
They had reached a smooth wire fence. Beyond it, the gantries of oil wells stood against the sky like sentinels the size of Lord Perth. How many had she said were still working? 19, he thought. The sound of them was ghastly, the sound of monsters being choked to death. Of course it was the kind of place that kids dared each other to go into, a kind of open-air haunted house. He held two of the wires apart so she could slip between them, and she did the same for him. As he passed through, he saw a line of white porcelain cylinders marching down the post closest to him. A fence wire went through each. "You understand what these are? Were?" he asked Susan, tapping one of the cylinders.
"Aye, when there was electricity, some went through here."
She paused, then added shyly,
"It's how I feel when you touch me."
He kissed her cheek, just below her ear. She shivered and pressed a hand briefly against his cheek before drawing away.
"I hope your friends will watch well."
"They will."
"Is there a signal?"
"The whistle of the Nighthawk. Let's hope we don't hear it."
"Aye, be it so."
She took his hand and drew him into the oil patch. 13. The first time the gas jet flared ahead of them, Will spat a curse under his breath, an obscenely energetic one she hadn't heard since her father died, and dropped the hand not holding hers to his belt.
"Be easy. It's only the candle, the gas pipe."
He relaxed slowly. "That they use, don't they?"
"Aye, to run a few machines. Little more than toys, they are. To make ice, mostly."
"I had some the day we met the sheriff." When the flare licked out again, bright yellow with a bluish core, he didn't jump. He glanced at the three gas storage tanks behind what Hambry folk called the candle without much interest. Nearby was a stack of rusty canisters in which the gas could be bottled and carried.
"You've seen such before?"
she asked. He nodded.
"The inner baronies must be very strange and wonderful," Susan said.
"I'm beginning to think they're no stranger than those of the outer ark," he said, turning slowly. He pointed. "What's yon building down there, left over from the old people?"
"Aye."
To the east of Sitgo, the ground dropped sharply down a thickly wooded slope, with a lane cut through the middle of it. This lane was as clear in the moonlight as a part in hair. Not far from the bottom of the slope was a crumbling building surrounded by rubble. The tumble and strew was the detritus of many fallen smokestacks. That much could be extrapolated from the one which still stood. Whatever else the old people had done, they had made lots of smoke.
"There were useful things in there when my dad was a child," she said. "Paper and such. Even a few ink writers that would still work, for a little while at least, if you shook 'em hard."
She pointed to the left of the building, where there was a vast square of crumbled paving,